Hi, my name is Bob Sander, and I'm a professional storyteller. For over 30 years, my repertoire has included a group of personal narrative stories. Some of these are childhood memories, stories lived when, well, basically when I was a knucklehead in training, so to speak. Other stories come from my college student era, and still others date from my time as a beginner parent. And you know, by then I was kind of a professional knucklehead. While I do tell personal tales that are, well, either too risque or too this or too that to include here, you know, if you come to dinner some night, we'll eat and drink and I'll spill the beans on all those stories. But this collection, this bunch makes the cut. So I hope you enjoy them. And as for truthfulness, well, just know that these stories are absolutely 100% as true as I can make them. Enjoy. My mother always said, "Bobby, if trouble knocks at the door, don't let it in." Now that sounds easy enough, but the thing is, trouble never looks like trouble. Take, for instance, my friend and neighbor Keith. He didn't look like trouble. So when he knocked at our front door one sweaty summer morning, I let him in without a second thought. And we plunged into our usual conversation. "Hey, Bobby, what are you doing?" "Hey, Keith, nothing." "You?" "Nothing. I'm bored." "Yeah, me too. I'm really bored." It was 9:15 in the morning. "Man, it sure is boring around here." "Yeah, you want to do something?"
"Yeah, yeah, what do you want to do?"
I don't know. What do you want to do?"
"I ask you first."
"Well, I ask you second."
"Well, you pick."
"No, you pick." It was almost like a tradition that we'd go on like this for maybe 5 minutes at a minimum. And we complied, and we kind of milked each round for all it was worth, which was not much. I'll spare you the details. Finally, we led up to this.
"Hey, I know," said Keith. "Let's get in your sandbox and make some forts. It's a really great sandbox."
Actually, it was not a sandbox at all. It was a single-axle truckload of sand that had been dumped in our backyard. My dad and several neighborhood men were going to pour a concrete patio near the back door of our house. They hadn't gotten around to it yet, and the pile became our sandbox, kind of by default. It was a toss-up to say who enjoyed that pile the most, Keith or me, or the neighborhood cats. My mom told us to stay out of it, but she must have intuited non-compliance, because she added we should at least try to avoid any of the little contributions the cats left behind.
"Whoa, okay, wait. I cannot play in the sandbox with you, Keith."
Keith grimaced like I'd just stuck canned spinach up his nose.
"Why not?"
"'Cause of the last time, remember?"
"No, you don't remember?
It rained and everything was wet, which was good because the sand was really packing, and we made those great forts, remember?"
"Yeah, we always make forts." I know, but these were the really great ones with towers and turrets, and each one had a tunnel underneath, remember?"
"Not yet."
"Oh, come on. Remember? And you and I, we had our metal army guys, and they were posted all over your fort, and mine were posted all over mine. And one of your guys was in your tunnel, just like mine was in my tunnel. And you said, 'Bombs away,' and you reached over and you smashed my tower, and it covered up my guy. So I did the same thing to your guy. Do you remember?"
"Oh, a little, maybe, not really."
"You don't remember when I said, 'Let's not do this anymore because it's not funny,' but you said it was funny, and I said it was not funny, and you said it was, and I said it was not, and then you picked up a bunch of sand."
"Sand?"
"Yes, sand, of course. What else? Then you said it again. You said it was funny, and just when I said it was not funny, you threw that sand in my face, and a whole bunch of it got in my eyes, and I couldn't get it out, and my mom had, she had to take me to the hospital to get my eyes flushed. And my dad said it cost the family a lot of money for me not to play in the sandbox with you again. Do you remember? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember now. That was really cool. So, but I guess we can't play in the sandbox? That's what I'm saying. Yeah, but I'm bored. What are we going to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? And we went through the whole routine again. Clocks would stop, and birds would fall out of the sky if we didn't. And then, Bobby, I know what let's do. Let's play golf. Oh, man, perfect golf. I love that. No, wait. Nope. Can't play golf with you. Why not? Because of the last time. You remember the last time? No, nuh-uh. All of our neighbors love to go to Rustic Gardens, a not-so-miniature golf course that we kids particularly loved. Plus, there was a driving range there. Our dads whacked golf balls with amazing force, some small portion of which even translated into straight shots. Of course, we wanted to be golfers just like them. There was only one thing to do, and that was beg for a set of golf clubs. Now, only professional politicians of long practice and proficiency can outwine and outwheedle a small child. Neither knows any shame or limits. With enough time, both get what they want, like soil erosion. Sooner or later, they just wear you down. Who wouldn't be powerless before a rant that knows no limit? So we got what we wanted, sort of. You know, parents have a sly way of giving in. Oh, they got us golf clubs, all right. But the catch was this. The clubs and the balls were just little, you know, kid-sized, made of plastic. Even our best strokes would only send the ball a few feet away. And if the slightest wind blew, the ball would stop in midair and fly back at you. That was embarrassing. I reminded Keith about all this. Yeah, so? Well, so, you don't remember this. We got sick of those stupid plastic clubs, and you said it was okay to get into your dad's closet and bring out the real ones. And so we did, remember? Sort of. Not exactly. Man, you're so dense. See, now, we had learned this word from a babysitter the week before. We were unsure of its exact meaning, but we nevertheless proceeded to use it to death. Now, the above example is a rare accidental correct usage. Huh? I'm not dense. Trust me, you are too. And we took your dad's golf clubs into your backyard and started swinging, but they're really long, and we didn't know that till we tried them, and it was really, really hard to hit a ball, but you finally did, remember? Okay. Okay, so what? I knew he didn't truly remember, or he had recalled a pretty major so what. So what is that you just dribbled the ball off the tee 3 times in a row? It only went like 3 inches. And I laughed till I just about peed myself. And you said I better stop. But I couldn't because it was just too funny. So you whacked me in the head with the golf club. And my mom drove me to the hospital and I had to get 5 stitches in my head. And my dad got really mad that time. He said, what was I trying to do? Buy St. Francis Hospital? Which to me, that makes no sense at all. But that's what he said. Oh, yeah, now I remember. That was great. Well, but that's why I can't play golf with you. Yeah, but I'm bored. Yeah, me too. Well, we gave our shtick a last half-hearted run-through. We were kind of losing steam. If we didn't think of something pretty quick, a parent would see us and make us play a game I used to play when I was your age. Oh, anything but that. Keith finally nailed it, though.
Wait, I got it. Let's go get in your dad's garage. He's got all kinds of neat stuff in there.
All right, that's just brilliant. No, I can't play in the garage.
Oh, man, not again. Honest to God, I don't remember any last time to do with your garage.
Nope, you don't, because you weren't there. It was just me. What had happened was this. Nobody had air conditioning yet, just an assortment of fans. On the worst August days and nights, they helped a little. Our fan was a window fan. Prop it in an open window, seal off the edges to keep the bugs out, and when the cool of the evening came, you turned on that fan. Now, in theory, it would push hot air out of the house at
one window and suck in cooler air from another open window in a distant room. Kind of a cool breeze effect. I have no idea if that fan accomplished its intended purpose. I was always preoccupied enjoying its other abilities. Chief among these was the fact that if you put your mouth right up against the wire guard of a rapidly churning fan, now, these were MAME-worthy metal blades in those days, not little wimpy plastic ones. So if you put your mouth up there and yell, the resulting sound of your voice was just priceless. Now, if you've never tried this, I still recommend trying it without reservation. On a certain spring day before the fan was put in the window, I had slipped out into the garage. And Keith was right. There was always an ample supply of fantastic and sort of inscrutable objects in there. Now, among them was that window fan. It was on the floor, and it was ready to be used. I plugged it into a wall socket, sat down in front of it, crushed my mouth up against the wire cage, and I bellowed. Bah! My voice fractured magically, kind of like this. My mother always made me quit after a couple of minutes when I did this in the house. Jesus H. Christ, she'd say. Are you trying to drive me bonkers? I had no idea where bonkers was, though I did like the idea of driving to most anywhere. But here in the garage, with my mother out of the picture, sky was the limit. I yammered into that fan for probably 15 minutes. And gradually, something dawned on me. There was no screen guard on the back of that fan. It was totally open. I went back there and sat, mute, entranced by the whirring movement. The blades were a complete blur. Unless you blink your eyes really quickly. You ever done that? Somehow, if you do that, blink your eyes really quickly, it makes a momentary mental snapshot of the blades as if they were at rest. Anyway, that all reminded me of something. And what was it? Oh, yeah. The spokes on my bicycle wheels. Turning spokes. They were just like that. And what did we kids do with those turning spokes? Why, we took clothespins and fixed baseball cards onto the fork so they stuck into the path of those spokes. Of course. That low-cost improvement made the closest imitation to the sound of a motorcycle's whine that we could devise. Bike tires were okay for this, except for one thing. They were limited by our 5-year-old's ability to pedal. But here, I realized, here was a mechanism with virtually no speed limit. I switched that fan onto its highest speed, and those racing blades all but disappeared. At that speed, the fan achieved an impressive decibel level all its own. Pretty good, I thought, but wait till I stick a baseball card in there. Maybe it was the impatience of youth that tripped me up. My delight and eagerness was certainly considerable, but for whatever reason, I could not wait long enough to walk in the house and get a baseball card. No, I wanted to test this sound out immediately. I decided to use whatever was close at hand instead. Now, close at hand is probably the right metaphor in this case, because what did I decide to use? Yes, you're right. How about a finger? What could go wrong? Let me clarify. That idea came to me, and I rejected it, or it seemed like I rejected it. Instead, here's what happens. Before I tell you what happens, let me give you this aside. As an adult, I met a farmer who told me about moments like this. Temptation just beckons. Something jams the cutter bars of a harvester or a combine, and a sweet and irrational voice whispers in the ear, "It'll be all right. Reach in there. Just reach in there and pull that out." He told me how, even as he said aloud, "That's stupid, in no way," an unidentified hand appeared, grabbed the object and yanked, and it was his hand, acting on strange, contrary instructions from deep within, and a digit was lost. That describes my day with the fan pretty well. Like the farmer, I think I rejected that finger idea. It was more like one of those what-if questions that we all ask now and then. But suddenly, there it was, the unidentified hand, an index finger extended, answering the gyre of that fan. I watched, fascinated. I wondered, what idiot was so bold as to try out my idea? Luckily for me, a second hand appeared and closed around my wrist. I recognized that hand perfectly well. It was my dad's. And with a huge, prodigious, he pulled me back from that harm's way. "What in the Sam Hill do you think you're doing? You could have cut your finger off." He expelled me out the garage with a swift whack to my bottom. Then he told me not to play in there again without him around. And he added something else. "Start saving right now, Buster. You're going to need it to buy your own private hospital. And they don't come cheap." What was this obsession about me owning a hospital? I just could not figure that out. "Man," said Keith, "you're a total dense." He grinned and nodded. We both knew he'd do the same thing in my place. "You're dense. But anyway, that's why I can't play in the garage. Look, if we don't do something pretty soon, we'll go completely dense. Come on, it'll be all right. Let's get in your dad's garage anyway." "Well, okay." He really twisted my arm on that one, huh? "Get ready now. Here comes the last of this story. Lots of things are getting ready to happen, but don't worry. It's going to go off as fast as a string of firecrackers. At least that's the way it seemed to us 5-year-olds. You'll be done reading this one in time for lunch." As soon as we went into the garage, there it was, that fan. And I swear I heard it call my name. "No way," I said to my internal agitator. That's the one who always tempted me to do things I'd been told not to do. Instead, my gaze settled on something else. Right next to the fan sat a plastic bucket 2 feet tall. It was full near to the top with some fine, fine, ever so fine powder, white powder. Keith saw it too. "Let's play with that bucket of stuff," he said. Still smarting from the fan trouble, I agreed right away. "Okay, but no, wait. My dad says I'm not supposed to play in here." "So," I announced, "let's take it out behind the garage. The letter of the law is better than nothing, right?" We sat down, legs folded Indian style, one of us on each side of that bucket. "What is this stuff?" Keith asked. "I know exactly what it is," I said. I had no idea in the world what it was. But at a certain age, you know, seeming to know something is a lot more important than actually knowing. "It's bucket makeup," I pronounced. "Bucket makeup? But what's bucket makeup?" I gave Keith a withering look. "Man, I bet you were born with a 20-pound dent on your head. Bucket makeup. Your mom and my mom both have those big, round, hinged thingies with the mirror inside, right? A compact? Yeah, a compact. And on the bottom half, it's all that little powder puff jobby. And what are they always smearing it into? The white powder they put on their faces? Yeah. That's what this is? Obviously. This is where they keep it? Obviously." Now, this laughable assertion was so wildly untrue, it could have qualified for a place in the Guinness Book of World Records under the heading lunacy. If only I'd had the wit to apply when it mattered. Immediately, we did as we'd seen our mothers do, though with much less restraint. The first faint finger dabs quickly gave way to fingers full, then whole hands full. A tiny cloud of white, powdery dust filled the air between us. We were laughing to beat the band. Our regular skin color vanished beneath the increasingly thick slather of bucket makeup. Oh, man, did that powder stick to our skin. Powder's probably the wrong word here. There was so much of it, and we were so amazingly sweaty by now that white cake-like substance would be a better description. At some point, I looked over at Keith. He was gone. In his place, there was a near exact replica of a television advertising image I'd seen hundreds of times. It was the famous Pillsbury Doughboy. Every hair, nostril, earlobe, every eyelash and freckle, even his fingernails were vividly, shockingly white. "You look so stupid, it's dense." I was nearly crying with laughter. Keith looked at me and laughed as well. "Nuh-uh, you look stupid." He was melting with laughter. We squealed about this for quite a while. I don't remember exactly when it wasn't funny anymore. You know how things like that sometimes just turn on a dime. But for Keith, the moment had already come. I noticed too late that he had a whole handful of white powder gripped in his hand. "I do not look stupid," he said. He wasn't smiling, and I missed that cue. "You do too," and he let fly with that powder. just like that. Powder was flying back and forth, back and forth. We're just throwing handfuls of it at each other willy-nilly. Turned out to be a good thing because we were laughing again. I felt that powder go down the back of my T-shirt, snake its way into my Fruit of the Loom underwear. Likely it was in my socks as well. Likely it was everywhere. Hold it! Hold it! No, really, Keith, stop. Really, stop! I looked in the bucket. Now there was 2 inches of powder left way down at the bottom. We got to stop before my dad notices any of this is missing. Close call. And just like that, it was over. Doughboy and I put the bucket away, and we headed for his mother's house. We were going to raid the cookie drawer. When we arrived, we noted that his mother was not in the kitchen. She had already cleaned the kitchen. Now she was cleaning the bathroom. We could hear her in there. Squeak, went the cookie drawer as we pulled it open. That wood needed oiling. We waited and listened. On the radio, Porter Wagoner and Dolly Parton were singing out a country tune. Marguerite sang along as she bristle-brushed the worst of the toilet stains. Now the song changed. We could hear her singing some more. Please release me, let me go. The singing covered up the noise of our cookie invasion. A sliding tin top on the bread drawer was still common in the 50s, so even after you pulled the drawer out, you still had to slide that tin top back. This one just fit miserably. We knew it was going to make a horrendous noise. We waited for a crescendo in the singing and gave it a pull. Marguerite kept singing. We were too short to see over the top of the drawer, so I stuck my hand through the opening. Blindfolded or in the dark, I knew the feel I was looking for immediately. It was the dentist's best friend and every kid's dental downfall. I whispered a whisper to the doughboy, "It's sugar wafers." His eyes glazed. He became visibly giddy. He danced on one foot. He might have peed himself with excitement, but there was no way to know for sure. We were too covered in wet, white, powdery goo to tell. He motioned for me to slide the tin top back all the way, enough to snatch the goods. I risked it. In way less than a second, Marguerite was on us like white on rice. "Oh my God, what have you done to this kitchen?" She seemed strangely unconcerned about the cookie heist. What was up?
"I just washed and waxed this floor. My God, look at it now."
The floor? We looked. Until that moment, cookie lust had blotted out our vision for anything other than our quarry. Marguerite's spiraling anger brought us back down to earth. As the cookie haze lifted from our eyes, we saw it, a huge swath of caked and cracked white mud-like barnacles all over the floor. Slowly, we began to connect them with their point of origin, which was us.
"Keith, your daddy's going to tan your hide. What is all this stuff?"
The doughboy was entirely silent. His lips moved, but no sound came out. He was busy assembling the mental picture of his irate father and what was likely to follow.
"Bobby Sander, you tell me right now, what is all over the two of you?"
"Bucket makeup. I guess it's best to tell the truth, especially when you don't have a better story."
"Bucket makeup? You know, Marguerite, like you and Mom use. You know.
And here I pantomimed a little powder to the face movement to illustrate. Now, the mere absurdity of the thought confused her for a moment. She quickly shook it off. And after that, she was all action. She grabbed us by the ears, and not in a very kind way. And with her elbows slashing through the air, she half-drug, half-led us to the front steps of my house. She was talking to herself all the way.
"Clean and clean and clean and clean. What good does it do? Always into something. General Hospital starts in 4 minutes. I'm going to mess the best part. I just know it. If I were her, I'd leave him flat. Leon's going to skin these boys alive. Knock, 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 knock."
Nobody knocked on the front door except strangers or salesmen. All the neighbors just stuck a head in and yelled, "Anybody home?" But this was a special occasion, and evidently it demanded some special theatrics to go with it. My mother was soon at the door.
"Francis, these boys said they got into your bucket makeup. I told them you don't have this much makeup in all the world, but just look at them."
My mother was hard to shock, but today we give her a run for her money. I noticed a slight giveaway movement of her lower lip. We must have looked pretty impressive from a trouble point of view.
"It's just your makeup, Mom. We might have used a little too much. But if we did, I'll buy you some more."
Like I had any money. Makeup? I don't have this much makeup. It's your bucket makeup, Mom.
Then I added with a little conspiratorial wink, you know.
My what?
Your bucket makeup.
Are you saying bucket?
Of course I was. Man, she must have had dents for breakfast, though I didn't say that.
Yeah, you know, in the garage.
I winked a little more. Maybe it was a secret, even from Marguerite.
Show me,
she said, and we were all off to the garage. The big plastic bucket was right behind the door in its proper place. There wasn't much makeup left in it.
Maybe we used too much.
Sorry, Mom. With absolutely no warning at all, my mother grabbed us both by the arms and threw us into the white 1957 Ford Fairlane.
Hospital!
She screamed at Marguerite, now standing with her mouth gaping open. A moment later, we tore off down the street at an impressive rate of speed. I'd never seen my mother drive like this before. She looked to be concentrating something fierce, but it wasn't working because she missed almost all the lights and stop signs on the way to the hospital. Plus, she was crying. We started crying, too, though not for any reason we could name. But listen, when your mother cries and streaks around like a demolition derby driver, you cry, too. We got to St. Francis Hospital in what seemed like 10 seconds. An ambulance was in the emergency bay unloading someone on a stretcher. No matter. My mom cut right in front of them. A second later, we were in the emergency room, the waiting area, each of us locked in one of her clenched hands.
They're dying! They're dying! Oh, my God, please help us, someone!
This was news to us. We actually thought the crisis moment, death by car wreck, had passed. Now what? Then, the best thing that could have happened did happen. Our new, young family doctor, our old doctor expired at the Methuselah-like age of 60. The new doctor was doing rounds at the hospital that day. He heard my mother's voice from across the room, and he came over. He was a very friendly man, kind of a gentle giant type. He was quick with a riddle or a joke or a tickle in the ribs. He knew how to bring calm. "Francis, Francis," he said as he came over and held her by the shoulders. "It's going to be all right. Is there trouble?" This was disingenuous. He knew trouble when he saw it, unlike me, and he'd already seen us. The words were mostly to gentle my mother.
"They're going to die. They are going to die. I just know it."
"No, no, no. They're not going to do any such thing, not if I can help it. Why would you say that?" And here it came. Here it came at last. How bad could it possibly be?
"Ant poison, ant poison. The boys have been eating pounds and pounds of ant poison. They're going to die. I just know it."
For some unfathomable reason, my dad regarded the massive accumulation of ants on our sidewalks as a problem. On any given day, they'd suddenly emerge in uncountable numbers, literally swimming on top of each other. Maybe it was a colony of red ants versus a colony of black ants. Maybe it was mating season. Maybe they wanted to go to the Indy 500. I don't know. All we kids knew or cared about was they were there by the millions. It was more than we could have hoped for. We checked for them every day. When they did appear, it was simple to scoop up whole jars full of them. You could do a lot of great and unexpected things with a whole jar full of ants. But my dad conspired to get rid of them. O.D. Driscoll of Driscoll's Hardware Store sold him enough ant poison to choke every ant in North America. "The price was right," my dad said later. "Plus, you never can tell. A little extra ant poison might be just the thing someday." Yup, we proved that. Since we finally knew now why my mom thought we were dying, we began to cry in earnest. Dr. Dill tried to comfort my mother again. She was not having any of it. She wanted us treated, but she was sure it was too late.
"I know it's too late. They are gone for sure."
Doc looked at us. "Is that right, boys? Did you eat that stuff?" We blubbered. I tried to say something more in our defense, but it came out mostly as unintelligible gibberish. I did manage to pantomime how it was in my underwear. Francis, calm down, calm down. The boys said they didn't ought eat it. It's just all over them. I'll get them cleaned up, and they'll be all right." But my mother had reached her own conclusion, and there was no dissuading her. She knew how truthful we kids were about confessing to things we'd eaten on the sly, which is to say, not very, so she raved on. Moving right along in spite of my mother, Doc pressed on. He did what needed to be done. And that's how the worst thing that could have happened did happen. "Nurse," he called out in a loud voice. Our doctor's personal nurse from his office was there with him that day. She didn't like kids very much. We knew that for a fact. Whenever we went to get booster shots, she always administered them with a nasty grin. She'd say, "This is going to hurt you a lot more than it will me," she'd say, "because it won't hurt me at all." And now, here she was. She looked over at us. "Well, the boys here got into some ant poison," said the doc. "Would you please get them cleaned up? Maybe use that little maintenance room down the hall. There's a shower in there. No need to get a perfectly good room dirtied up." And that was it. Doc had assessed the scene, and he dealt with it. He patted my still grieving mother on the shoulder, gave each of us doughboys a smile and a wink. And 2 seconds later, he was gone, paged to another part of the hospital for more serious matters.
"Strip."
"What?" I asked her, too dazed by the turn of events to make sense of her one word, order.
"I said strip. You know, take off your clothes."
I thought she might be kidding. She wasn't.
"Did you think you can traipse down the hallways of this sanitary institution with contaminated clothes on, dripping ant poison all over the place?"
She made it sound like an elaborate plot. In truth, 10 minutes ago, I hadn't planned to be here at all. I took a stand.
"No!"
"No what?" I looked at my fellow doughboy. He shook his head in silent agreement with me.
"No, we won't take our clothes off."
"For God's sakes, there were all kinds of people around watching. Some of them were girls." I looked to my mother for support. She was still lamenting our imminent demise, maybe even visualizing our funerals. But in the depths of her grief, the look on her face said it clearly. "I ain't going to rescue you on this one." Nurse got right in our faces.
"Either you take them off, or I'll take them off for you, and that won't be fun."
We took them off. It was worse than humiliating. I remember thinking it couldn't get worse than this. And then, on cue, it got worse. Underwear, too. Like I said, this was the 50s. The whole privacy thing was years in the future. As far as anyone could tell that day, these were just two knuckleheaded kids getting their just rewards. In fairness, it's possible the nurse realized we wouldn't be revealing anything to any great extent. So much sweat and tears had mixed together with literally pounds of ant poison as to have caked over all of our bodies with a thick crust. And in truth, once disrobed, we scarcely even looked human. She led us down the hallway to the maintenance room. There was a little shower closet in one corner. "In there," she said. We thought she'd let us shower in private. No such luck. Instead, she picked up a short length of what looked to be fire hose, coiled up on a hanger just outside the shower stall. She dialed the nozzle down to emit a needle-pointed stream of water, and just before she cranked it up to full blast, cold as possible, she said with a grin,
"This is going to hurt you a lot more than it will me, because,"
and that's all we heard. Cold water struck every inch of our bodies with skin-piercing intensity. Our crusty veneer of gooey white flicked and flaked and dissolved, and a bright red hue took its place. Those 4 minutes took 3 days to go by. Afterwards, nurse dressed us up in hospital gowns, and I had never worn one of those before. We were insensible to nearly everything at this point anyway. It was no time to notice the finer points of hospital dress. This accounts for our puzzlement as we passed various people in the hallway on our walk back to the lobby. Almost all of them snickered as we passed by. We were too busy sniffling and feeling sorry for ourselves to pay them much attention. How were we to know that our tail ends were open and hanging out there to the world? Funny how, when parents think you're in really bad trouble, they suffer the pangs of hell from worry. And then, when the danger passes and it appears you're going to be all right, their worry doesn't merely just go away. No. It is instantly replaced with something else. "I'm going to kill you," my mother said as soon as we appeared, looking completely alive and well, if somewhat unnaturally scarlet. And that's when I learned about the unique way hospital gowns are made.
As I walked by her, she saw my exposed rear end and gave it a smack. Whack!
Don't you cry, she said, because that's nothing compared to what your daddy is going to do when he hears about this.
Prophetic words indeed. 2 weeks later, there was a knock at my front door. It was 8:30 in the morning. Keith stood on the front porch.
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Keith.
What you doing?
Nothing. You?
Nope, nothing. I'm bored.
Yeah, me too. I'm really bored. It's completely boring in here.
It's totally boring out here.
Let's do something.
Sure. What do you want to do?
What do you want to do? And you know that routine. After the usual 5-minute palaver, Keith said,
Hey, I know. Let's go get in your daddy's garage.
I squinted at Keith out of the corner of my eye. Could Trouble actually disguise himself to look like my friend Keith? I considered that possibility for just a moment.
No, surely not.
Just to be on the safe side, I said,
Nah, that's dense. Let's go get into your mama's cookie drawer instead.
And that's what we did. And that's the end.